Okay, our final presenter this morning is Mae Kennedy. She's an associate professor of social and behavioral health at Virginia Commonwealth University and the director of graduate training there. The title of her presentation, Triangulation of Formative Data in an Infant Mortality Prevention Campaign.
You just click. Okay. Good morning. I'm going to talk to you today about triangulating results of formative research collected in the process of a social marketing campaign in Richmond, Virginia. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, and please note that they include the Promoting Healthy Pregnancies Coalition, which is a group of maybe 30 service providers in Richmond. I have no relationships that are a conflict with regard to this presentation, but there is a kind of an interesting story there, which I'll tell you later. In Richmond, as elsewhere, there is a severe racial ethnic disparity in infant mortality. And the Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine has a five-year center grant to address the problem, and it is composed of five studies, three of which are bench science, one of which involves home visiting, and one of which is what we call the Community Outreach Corps, and that's what I'll be talking to you about today. The Community Outreach Corps was not as well-funded as the bench science. It was conceived of, I think, really, frankly, as a public relations aspect of the study, but we took it seriously. The project staff included a young woman who has a master's degree in counseling. We have 60% of her time, the odd temporary intern, and several of my colleagues, each of whom contributed a very small percentage of their time. We employed social marketing, which is variously defined, but the operational definition we used was the one in the social marketing version of CD Synergy, which is a product of the Centers for Disease Control and the Turning Point Initiative and the Academy for Educational Development in Washington, D.C. And it's available on the internet for free at this website. It's interactive, and it's literally a library on a hunk of plastic. I invite you to visit that site and see what there is for you to use. Social marketing is not PSAs and print materials. We call that social advertising. Social marketing really is an iterative strategic planning process in which decisions are data-based and the data is on the target audience. Our coalition has been through the first series of steps in red there, trying to focus the campaign. In contrast to Iman's approach, we as social marketers wanted to really focus on gaining market share on a specific behavioral outcome. You know, if you were a commercial marketer and you were working for Coke, you'd want 3% more this year in market share compared with Pepsi in terms of buying Coke. So that's the framework. We wanted to focus, which, by the way, is an unnatural act performed by unconsenting adults in public health. The people in public health always want to do everything for everybody all the time. You know, what about this group? What about that problem? In order to narrow our focus, we went through two rounds of formative research, and I'm going to show you what we did, nothing in any great detail because there's too much, but it'll give you an idea of the various kinds of data we pulled together. In the first round of formative research, we reviewed the literature on causes of infant mortality with the help of a wonderful professional librarian from our medical school. We collected key informant rankings of potential campaign foci. We obtained from a colleague in the epidemiology department at VCU a linked birth-death certificate study of causes of infant mortality in Richmond. And when it began to look like smoking was where we were going to go, we wanted to make sure that there was room for improvement in smoking behavior among pregnant African-American women. And so we acquired some self-report data from a clinic study. The literature review had multiple studies that listed smoking as a major risk factor for infant mortality and low birth weight. There were very few studies that had calculated relative risk in studying a variety of risk factors, but several of those that did found smoking to be the voluntary behavior responsible for the greatest percentage of mortality and morbidity. In addition, several authoritative sources said smoking cessation was the most important thing a woman could do to have a healthy baby. We also got key informant rankings of a series of voluntary behaviors, and the key informants included the principal investigators of the bench science studies, our community coalition partners also filled out questionnaires, and we asked them separately about high-risk pregnant women and high-risk non-pregnant women because we didn't know exactly what our target audience would be. The behaviors here and the rankings are listed for likelihood to make a difference in terms of infant mortality. And as you can see, smoking was highest for the investigators and about third for the community partners. We also asked them what would be feasible to bring about and what was already going on in the community service-wise that would be duplicative. And here we found that smoking, again, was about third. When you added and averaged all these numbers, smoking came out highest. We looked at linked birth-death certificate data. My colleague Saba Masho had done a study here and found that maternal lifestyle factors, including smoking, accounted for the greatest proportion of variance. And then we looked at the self-report data from the clinic and found that, sure enough, 32% of pregnant African-American women did smoke, so there was room for improvement. Now, even with all this, the problem was insufficiently focused from the point of view of a social marketer. It looked something like this. African-American women who are pregnant or may become pregnant soon or have infants or small children should not start smoking and should quit if they already smoke. And many women quit spontaneously when they learn they're pregnant, but some don't. And many quitters start smoking again shortly after delivery. We really needed to conduct even more formative research, a whole nother round, to pick a specific audience segment and a behavioral objective. We conducted 6 focus groups, and it turned out to be 5 focus groups and an in-depth interview because we only had one person show up for one of the focus groups. 9 phone interviews with national experts, people at CDC, and so on. Review of the literature on correlates of smoking and evidence-based anti-tobacco programs. One of the young women that was an intern conducted for us a secret shopper study, and this involves pretending to be a pregnant woman and trying to contact and access all of the available smoking cessation services in Richmond to see if somebody answers the phone, if they cost money, if the providers are crabby. We also had a conversation. It was starting to look like the smoking cessation quit line was the way to go. That was by far got the best ratings from our secret shopper and is evidence-based, as effective as face-to-face counseling or nicotine replacement therapy. And so we talked to the people at the Virginia Department of Health to find out if they could handle, with their available service capacity, any demand we would bring about, any increased demand we would bring about with an intervention, and they said yes, they could. The focus groups changed. As happens in qualitative research, the facilitator's guide evolved as we had a few focus groups and realized which questions and which audiences gave us the biggest payoff. And so you don't have IRB approval with this sort of iterative research. You have an IRB relationship. And you go back to IRB over and over again and get them to say, yeah, you can make these three small changes in your definition of your target audience and so on. We found that the most important contrasts were between pregnant smokers and pregnant women who were recent quitters. That's where the most interesting information came from. They said that they smoke to reduce stress. They said the health of the baby was the most important reason to quit. They said they would hide smoking from people that were people in their support networks that disapproved of smoking. And that a woman's own opinions and those of her children were salient. The focus group guide was really theory-based, and we used the theory of reason action along with barriers, benefits, triggers of smoking, information, health information channels, and preferred messengers to develop the items. And we thought we had initially called the program Grandma Says because we'd assumed that older African-American relatives, respected elders, would have the most impact. And the women said no, that they would have strong opinions, but that they really wouldn't pay that much attention to them. They could smoke in the bathroom. That it was really the women themselves that mattered and something their children might say. And they didn't know about available cessation resources, by and large. We utilized one of the CD Synergy wizards to put all of this, the coalition, to put all of this into a decision-making process. The coalition together gave numeric ratings for risk, impact, behavioral feasibility, resource feasibility, and political feasibility. And this is where that part of the story about conflict comes in. Richmond is the intergalactic headquarters of Philip Morris. And, it's a reality. A lot of people are employed by Philip Morris. Historically, tobacco's been terribly important in the region, and a lot of people smoke. We, through the miracle of the wizard, which really just sums up and averages these ratings that the group makes together, showed the group that their decision was that it was pregnant women who smoke who were the low-hanging fruit that we would be able to reach with our limited resources, and that the behavior was call the Virginia Quit Line, which was already funded, and all you have to do is call once and they call you back several times. So this is something that a social marketing campaign can actually bring about. We're not going to tackle addiction with PSAs and outreach worker backup, but we can get people to make one phone call. Now, I'd like to say that, it's clear that all of these various data gathering methods had threats to validity. However, the threats differed across method. So, and the methods all kind of led to the same conclusion. And so the coalition members really felt reassured by that. And they also went on to say that the research skills they acquired, we trained peer outreach workers to be focus group facilitators and showed them qualitative data coding and other things. And they felt that the research skills they acquired were a real significant benefit of coalition membership and allowed them to tolerate the time it took for strategic planning when there was so much urgency, in the problem. We found that conducting several kinds of formative research and triangulating the results around a conclusion can catalyze networking and data sharing among researchers and providers and focus on mortality prevention efforts. And there was some grieving, and I've got to say, you know, it's understandable. One of the buzzwords, evidently, and I'm fairly new to this area. I'm a social marketer. I don't know a great deal about maternal child health, but apparently interconceptional health is very much cutting edge, and people were a little disappointed not to be doing something that was terribly cutting edge, and they worried about the women who had children and secondhand smoke, and there was some grieving about not choosing certain segments and not choosing certain behavioral outcomes, but that didn't last long. And pretty quickly, they got excited about the potential this time to actually have a measurable, significant effect. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, at this time, I'd like to open the floor for any questions that you might have for our panelists. Oh, hi, Loretta. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to ask, when you were doing the research with Katrina, did you have familiar how to analyze the data? Because I know you have to analyze the data from their own perspective rather than from the researcher's perspective.
We did the inter-rater reliability and the theme coding. But we gave them the themes, the results, to make decisions about. So that's the way we handle that.
We screened them in the clinic on an audio computer, a CASI scale, and we used the Bailey scale for the initial, the Beck scale, I'm sorry. I'm a neonatologist as well, please forgive me. We used the Beck scale for the initial assessment, and when we called on the telephone, we used the Hopkins scale. So we have them classified as mild, moderate, and severe depression. Surely. You need to realize that we screened 2,900 women, and more than 450 of these women tested positive for depression. If anything, this is it's quite a high rate. I appreciate exactly what you're saying, and I would encourage that. But if I were to add something, if I were to go back and look at the instruments that we used, I would add an instrument to test for stress. Because now the emerging literature is showing a spectrum of presentation where stress and depression overlap significantly. And I think we would have captured probably more women if we used one of these instruments of measurements. But obviously, a culturally informed and culturally relevant measurement instrument for any symptom, especially related to social, cultural, and mental health issues, is very much encouraged.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for that question. If for those of you who couldn't hear it, it was about the relationship of C-section and preterm birth, specifically late preterm birth, actually. And Dr. Joanne Petrini, who heads up our perinatal data center, actually just authored a paper showing that cesarean delivery before 39 weeks, obviously, is driving preterm birth rates, particularly those of a late preterm birth rate. So yes, we're aware of the situation based on our own data. We're very much interested, and we have several initiatives. One is to educate both consumers and providers about C-section, and not, you know, the ACOG has a practice guideline that says a C-section shouldn't be done before 39 weeks of gestation if it's not for a medical reason. So just getting the word out both to women and providers about that guideline. We have, as I mentioned, in our prematurity, our preemie, what do you call that? Petition. Preemie petition, the call for hospitals to voluntarily assess their inductions in C-sections that are occurring before 39 weeks, if you know, make sure they're not being done or only being done for a medical reason. So we have several initiatives ongoing right now, and we'll see where we go. Thank you.
Any other questions? Right here.
Yesterday I heard a talk by Dr. Diana Romero from Hunter College, and it was about the TANF, the welfare reform, and she was showing that it didn't actually have an impact, measurable impact on childbearing, but it did have an impact on increasing rates of abortion. And you had mentioned that you thought that there was a correlation with welfare reform
Yeah, I don't know whether there is a correlation or not. I'm just showing that there's a blip in the data that coincides with the introduction of TANF, and then there's also another actual change in that trend in 2001, which is the end of that initial five-year time. So the women that were initially on TANF, you know, in 2006 and in 2001, they have to go off of welfare. We also had a lot of other things that happened in 2001. So using birth certificate data, we can't get at this. You know, but I'm just pointing out that it's just really curious that the rate's going down and then it slows down and then it changes again. So this data, it really needs an economist to look at this data, you know, and look at other things, as well as to look at, you know, maybe state-specific data where we would have other variables that you could link to the birth certificate about, you know, access to care and payment method and that type of thing. So all I'm doing is just pointing it out. But in doing anything further than that, we really can't do that with birth certificate data. Induced abortions, using CDC data for induced abortions, they went down throughout the period. So as far as explaining overall trends, for this data, it's not likely to be a factor on that.
Yes, go ahead, Loretta. It's for you, I guess.
In the 1980s, when we had a down surge in the economy, we also had an upward trend in 82, 83 with low birth rates and preterm. And I'm thinking now, if we start looking at something, we might want to look at where the stressors are now with the economy as it is, with the fact that there's a lot of people losing their homes, not having places to live, food insecurities in the inner city. And for pregnant women, that in Los Angeles, 41% of pregnant women go to bed hungry every night.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to look at stress, because we need to start getting something together now so we can start measuring it, because I think that you're going to find the life course of stress within pregnant women's experiences, that you're going to find African Americans have higher levels of stress, and they deal with stress differently. And like people say, we measure bad stress, but we don't measure good stress, or the stress of resilience. And I think that we need to look at both sides of that coin for the next set of data, because we know that the economy is going to have an impact. And how is it going to impact us? When is it going to impact us? And who is going to be able to take and get the data out there quick enough so that funders and agencies can start doing interventions earlier?
Well, I totally agree. And it's just interesting that this analysis that I presented today, I actually started working on it in different ways about 2 years ago. And just the timing now with the economic stuff is just, I don't know what the right adjective is, fortuitous, you know. That. I will also say that, you know, looking at these economic trends and all that, and I didn't, I tried to keep the numbers to a minimum in what I presented, but for single African-American female households in the United States, the poverty rate is over 30%, okay? So the attributable risk for this in the African-American population is so high here, you know, that all these other factors are just, you know, little blips in this. And as Loretta said, with the changing economy and all the different ways that our lives are being affected, you know, these populations are going to be affected even more, you know. So I will say that we couldn't look at 2005 data because they stopped giving us variables that were of interest in this on the 2005 data set. But the low birth weight rates and the preterm rates for a singleton, they went up, so the trends continued to go up. And I would expect when we get the 2008 data, we're going to see, and 2009 data, we're going to see it go up even more. You know. And also programs and stuff with the, you know, the bailout and all that, we're, you know, in great risk of losing funding for things that we've already got. You know, so we need more advocacy about protecting people in our population here.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I applaud the terminologies that you use because they're very, very important. But first, you know, the American Psychiatric Association and ACOG both recommend that women are screened for psychosocial and behavioral risk during pregnancy. We showed today that interventions make a difference, but I assure you that most women still receiving services are not screened routinely, and if they are, there isn't a response if they are screened positive. So it would delight me if all of us went out and advocate for screening pregnant women for psychosocial and behavioral risk, and that the backup of that is to be considering programs that respond to that risk. I think also if we're going to assume a community-oriented primary care approach towards the care of underserved populations during pregnancy, we should begin to adopt some terminologies that are community-focused and culturally informed. So if she's saying hunger, how many of us that are standing in a prenatal care clinic are asking a woman when she comes and sits across the desk from us, ma'am, how frequently do you go to bed hungry in a week? We are always so concerned about the medical interpretation of weight gain, for example, that we lack the perspective of what is relevant to their life reality. And we're not going to be able to resolve much of what has been described before. I was on the psychosocial and behavioral study group for the Surgeon General's topic, and we all related to stress, but the backdrop behind it is life reality. And so we need to deal with that life reality, and we need to emphasize that communities also, not just the healthcare delivery system, need to begin to emphasize the importance of health of pregnant women and understand the risk to the health of pregnant women and find also community-based solutions to assist these women in reaching safer and better goals regarding their pregnancy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, for the Medicaid and how either policies there
Thank you for that question. Yes, we have an Office of Governmental Affairs based in D.C. that works at the federal level, and then our chapters do a wonderful job working at the state level for advocacy and advocating for women and children. And Medicaid is something that we're very much interested in expanding the services under that program, particularly now looking at interconception health for us and extending the postpartum period. So we are continuing to push forward on that. Thank you.
We are seeking funding to do a proper evaluation. There's some evaluation built into the equipment because they record the number of calls and demographics and where the calls come from. So we have a little bit that will underestimate the effect. And we are currently doing message testing. There are two phases. You test message concepts and then you test copy. And so we're in that process, and we're, you know, seeking an ad agency that'll give us a lot of pro bono help. And so, you know, stay tuned. Hopefully, we will have a campaign to show you and some results next year.
You
mentioned that
your the helpline was more effective
in smoking cessation than NRT. I hear that correct? No, it's there's studies that show that it's as effective as face-to-face counseling. And this multi-session one, like the series sponsored by Free and Clear, which is a contractor to about 9 states, that particular protocol has been shown to be as effective as face-to-face counseling, more as NRT. And in some cases, the people, the phone counselors send free nicotine replacement to callers, but they don't with pregnant women.
Okay, any other questions? We're just about at time. Thank you so much for your attendance. Probably go to the register, you know, that main sort of huge
yes,
area.
Yes.
And ask about getting
all
access
right, because,
to it.
All right, I'm working with a physician who wanted a couple of these, and he's going to
yeah,
be giving a presentation.
Yeah, all of them would be on
okay,
yeah.
Okay, all right. And would they be other?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're already sort of in the system now, so yeah, you can check on that. Hi. Oh, okay, I don't either. That's hi, Key. Did,
oh, here it is. Thank you.
Yeah,
because it's published already. I'm with you. I'm not going.
Oh, right, yeah. Are you going to go to the
you know what? You have a good. Are you going to?
Yeah, we got
and this is for Thank you.
the culmination of everything that's there. You know, stress comes from.
Wow,
that was so wonderful. So wonderful. Learning a lot. It's growing very quickly. And may respond to that. Yeah. So we have a paper on the publication as well. Great meeting you all.
She's okay. She's okay. I got you.